Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Monday morning. Wow, it's another rainy Monday morning. Jeez. That's so odd.
What a novel concept.
Well, we had a sort of a nice weekend, right? We welcome you to the program and thank you for being with us. It's always a pleasure to be in your company. And also know that you can always write to us, panel@wamc.org. And all you have to do is write to us and stay on topic and short and sweet and all that good stuff, and we would love to hear from you this morning. We have a wonderful panel to talk to, and we welcome them. Let me begin with Dr. Alan Chartok. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Well, I am a member of the SOFB, the Society of Flooded Basements.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear. Well, I mean, with all the rain we've been having, I guess it's no wonder. But so,
we never had that before, really.
Yeah.
So everybody in the family, our guests, and everybody took turns, and we got all the water out of there. You know, it's going rather well. You learn all kinds of things. Like, for example, you learn to look for any of the drain pipes, which may have been disconnected, in which case that's exactly where the water was. Exactly where the water was coming in. Anyway, it was really quite a great experience.
So you have your scuba gear on and you're ready to broadcast.
And yes.
Excellent. Thank you for being here. We also welcome UAlbany lecturer in Africana Studies, Dr. Jennifer Burns. Good morning.
Good morning, everyone. Glad to be here.
Wonderful to have you on the program. Always good to have you here. Jim Henler joins us, Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI, Director of the RPI-IBM Artificial Intelligence Research Collaboration. But wait, there's more! Jim has just been named the chair of the Technology Policy Council for the Association of Computing Machinery. That is the ACM. And the ACM Technology Policy Council, Jim is now chair of that. And I congratulate you.
Yeah, someday I'll learn how to say no when they ask me these things. But I just want to tell you, Alan, my flood this morning was in my kitchen, but that's because our refrigerator seems to have died last night. So.
The refrigerator didn't like the rain.
No.
Or the heat or something, yeah.
Well, Jim, we congratulate you on your new assignment, thank you for being with us. And I only have two words to describe Libby Post, which is political consultant, but there are so many more I could use.
Yes,
but only glowingly. And so I just introduce my dearest and oldest friend, Libby Post. How are you?
I'm good, Joe.
Good to see you.
Nothing flooded in our house this weekend, thankfully.
Good.
Yes.
Good. Yeah. Well. Yeah.
Knocking wood.
Yeah. Yes. I feel like the day's young.
We've had our share, though.
Yeah.
We really have.
The weather is quite something, and we have more flood warnings. And, of course, you can stay tuned to WAMC, and we have all the updates for you. A lot of weather stuff this summer, so good place to keep track of it right here. All right, let's get started and talk about what else is making news this morning. And there are other things making news this morning and this weekend. I think we've talked about this before, but, you know, they just don't, these news days are not what they used to be, which is really weird and kind of lovely. So.
you mean there's not a Trump in the headlines? Is that what you mean?
That is exactly.
I know, it's
actually,
great, isn't it?
Actually, there was. He went to talk to the conservatives and he did the usual garbage that he...
The CPACAE, they've added things just so they could have an extra Trump rally.
All right. Maybe I'll run. I'll let you know.
Yeah.
Oh, no. He's going to run. I have no doubt about it.
Can they run from jail?
We've talked about this, but I think they can.
They just can't vote for themselves.
Yeah. So let's
certainly talk. Florida.
We'll begin with Haiti, and don't worry, folks. We're going to be talking about voting, and we're going to be talking about Fox News. So we will be bringing up Trump's name throughout the broadcast. But let's talk about Haiti. Police say that the suspect in killing of Haiti's president planned to assume the presidency. And now, of course, Haiti is looking as much as possible for help from the United States and to try to find out what is happening. Sporadic gunfire erupted in Port-au-Prince over the weekend, piercing the relative calm that followed the killing as violent gangs threatened to fill the power vacuum in a country that now has no clear leader. One powerful gang leader called his followers to the streets as residents shuttered their doors against the possibility of more bloodshed in a city already terrorized by criminal violence. So there have been coming to the, Claude Joseph, who is the acting prime minister, has been recognized internationally but challenged at home, has asked the United States and the United Nations to send troops to help provide security. Pentagon spokesman John Kirby said Sunday that the request was under review. We're analyzing it just like we would any other request for assistance here at the Pentagon. Asked by host Chris Wallace of Fox News Sunday whether the events in Haiti are a matter of U.S. national security, he said, I don't know that we're at a point now where we can say. So, while they're mulling that over, let us talk about what we think as far as this goes. Alan.
Well, I've made it clear that we know nothing, really. We don't know what agencies of our government have been involved with Haiti, and you can be sure that security agencies and others have been doing that. So we don't really know what our responsibilities are. It's one of the reasons that a democracy is so important, because if people don't know, how can you support one policy, you know, or another? And we do not know.
Jim Hendler.
You know, I agree with Alan completely. Our history with Haiti is very complex. It goes back a long time, and does not reflect on us well until the past few years, and even then it was supporting someone who looked legitimate for a while and then became, you know, pretty much another Haitian dictator. So it's been a complicated thing there, and I agree with Alan that knowing what's going on is really hard, because the situation just seems very bizarre.
Libby Post.
I don't have a lot more to add to this. It's no one, I mean, as Alan and Jim and I, and who knows who else is going to say, you know, we really don't know what this is about. Is this guy, the doctor that they say is heading this whole thing up, did he really think he was just going to be installed as president? Are the gangs going to come together, as they said in the story, to foment more violence in the streets to quote-unquote protect their democracy, if there is one? What I found fascinating was supposedly the doctor who's involved in this, who's Haitian-American, you know, recruited a team through a Venezuelan security firm based in the United States. And I'm like, really?
Yeah.
Really?
Well, and we're learning a lot more about those responsible for the killing and their backgrounds, too. And as that picture emerges, it sort of adds to the overall murkiness of this. Jennifer Burns.
Well, I think, you know, I don't have a ton to add, except that I do think it's Biden's strategy of sending American, you know, officials that are Homeland Security officials and people like that to, air quote, aid or help with the investigation is really how we are proceeding in how America will help or not. And I also think there's a big part of that looking at how this is going to impact our immigration policies, because I think that's one of the major fears for the Biden administration, with Harris now taking up immigration from Latin America and from the Caribbean area. So I think that's another side dish, I guess I'll say, to what's going on here, because we really don't know, except for the way things are connected globally in the sense of Venezuelan security in America, recruiting Colombians, perhaps, Haitian Americans involved. So it's still very convoluted. But the immigration piece, I think, is definitely something the Biden administration is paying attention to here.
And that that nature of it, as you were talking about other parts of that region, you know, you look at what's happening in Cuba with the protests, too, and the great unrest there and rallies that are widely viewed as just astonishing for a country that, that limits dissent. But they have an economic crisis, and the pandemic is blamed for much of that.
COVID crisis.
Amazing. Does anybody find it interesting that these people were able to just walk into the presidential palace?
The residence,
and do this? There didn't seem to be security. There didn't seem to be any.
Well, I don't mean to be flip, but we didn't think you could go into the Capitol that way either.
Yeah, I know. Well, but they had to, like, break windows and things like that at the Capitol. And there were people.
There were a lot of people.
And they also, there were people who were killed by security
Does anybody think of the words Bay of Pigs? I mean, you know, that's the problem. If the United States has made any kind of assurances to any of these parties, as was apparently what happened with Kennedy and the Bay of Pigs, there may be something more here than we know, and I suspect there is.
And so do you mind fleshing that out just a little bit? Because I think I'm on the same page as you, but I don't, meaning that we're more involved than we say we are?
Yes. I think there certainly is that possibility, Joe. We don't know. The whole question of U.S. involvement in this, the way in which we made assurances to the anti-Castro people in the Bay of Pigs situation, long time ago now, it doesn't seem that long ago, but it is.
1961.
That was a long time ago, right?
It sure is, yeah.
60
years ago.
I'm thinking, you know, that our expertise is limited in terms of what this government is doing or thinks it's doing.
That's a great point. Anybody else on that?
I can't imagine that the Biden folks would be in back of something like this. I could sort of see this being a leftover of Trump, but who knows?
I can also see, you know, we have such craziness here now with hired terrorists.
Right. Who knows who's doing
craziness.
What?
And this whole thing about this guy with 23 people was supposed to march in and become the president. I mean, that's either delusional or conspiratorial, and we don't know which one.
Or a little bit of both.
Right.
Which, in this day and age, can make you the president of America.
Yeah, so, right. It's true.
It's all a lot going on in on that front. We welcome your letters on that, panel@wamc.org. Let's move on to other topics, too. And I'd like to talk a little bit about Texas voting measures. We look at this and see that a Republican-backed bill to overhaul the state's voting system cleared two key committees in the legislature yesterday after a marathon session of testimony in the House that lasted nearly 24 hours. So a day of testimony and these marathon hearings and the legislation has moved forward. The legislation is to overhaul the state's voting system and could be passed. Fierce opposition, of course, from the Democrats. The committee votes coming just days into a 30-day special session adhere to Governor Greg Abbott's timetable for a swift action on the legislation, which he called a priority for his administration. The full 31-member state Senate is expected to vote on its bill as early as tomorrow. The 150-member House is also likely to take up its own version of the measure this week. Democrats on both committees united in opposition to the bills and prepared for further combat on the floors of the Senate and the House. Beverly Powell, a state senator from the Fort Worth suburbs who voted against the bill in committee, said Senate Democrats were planning many amendments during the floor debate and might try to introduce an alternative bill. The Senate State Affairs Committee took about 45 minutes on Sunday afternoon to approve the bill. On a 6-3 party line vote after slightly modifying with 9 Republican amendments, we feel good about the bill, said Brian Hughes, the Republican committee chairman. We are also seeing hundreds of Texans flocking to the Capitol over the weekend for the committee hearings on the companion voting bills being pushed by Republicans, part of the national effort by the party to impose new restrictions on state election systems. Republicans say the restructuring is necessary to improve voter integrity, but Democratically aligned opposition forces are fighting what they call an unprecedented campaign to suppress voting. Alan.
Well, there's no question about it. They're trying to steal it.
Mm-hmm.
They're changing the rules in all of these states where, for example, you take an Arizona or you take any of these other places, and Texas, where you certainly, Abbott would probably see himself as a presidential candidate. So they're trying to steal it. And we are sitting here like a bunch of, you know, mute people, not saying what we need to say about the greatest threat that democracy has probably ever had. Trump is trying to steal the election again, and he may well get away with it.
You look at these bills, they would ban 24-hour voting, drive-through voting sites, increase the criminal penalties for election workers who run afoul of regulations, limit what assistance could be provided to voters, and expand the authority and autonomy of partisan poll watchers, among other provisions. The one there of limiting what assistance could be provided to voters is really, please, I need help. No, we can't give it to you. Go scratch. Sorry. That is really incredible.
My fear is what I find is the enabling partisan poll watchers and election inspectors to have more power. I mean, you know, I've lived
in power post-election,
right,
too.
I've lived in Albany long enough to know how the Board of Elections and election inspectors and poll watchers can be used to disrupt an election. Thankfully, we now have a really good Democratic commissioner in Albany County, Kathy Donovan, and hopefully some of that's going to go by the wayside. But it's easy to subvert an election, even in a state like New York, where you don't have these restrictions. And so can you imagine what would happen if, you know, a partisan poll watcher or election inspector is like, no, I don't like her. And I don't like the way she voted because, you know what, I know how she voted because that's part of the new thing. And so, no, her vote's not going to count.
But you know the other thing we don't have in New York? We don't have 24-hour voting. We don't have drive-by voting and drive-in voting. You know, so we are very much at a disadvantage, too. I mean, we are not voting on restrictions to make it harder, but it already is hard.
It's easier than it used to be because of early voting. And it's going to take a while for people to really take advantage of that in New York State. 24-hour voting, I don't know if we'll ever get there. And it's a costly thing.
Hmm.
The early voting issue has cost local boards quite a pretty penny as well.
But Libby, you don't think that people, that the political class in New York, the Democrats, who are a solidly blue state, you don't see them as trying to do. Cause
oh, no, no, no.
If you listen to your words, you know, Texas, there's no question.
Yeah,
Arizona,
no.
There's no question.
No.
New York, they don't have to do anything.
No, they don't have to, and that's not what I'm saying. I know that on the local level,
30 seconds,
you can play games. But no, New York has actually broadened election laws and access, and what Texas and some of these red states are trying to do is make them more narrow so people can't vote, and so people like Greg Abbott, like Donald Trump, can get elected.
Jennifer Burns and Jim Henler, I want you to weigh in on this topic as well. We'll take a quick break, and then we'll come back to both of you. We welcome your letters as well on this and other topics. Panel at WAMC.org. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Monday morning. We've been talking about Texas voting measures and overall voting measures and getting the
Gesundheit.
Again, second time I've sneezed on the air in a week. That's weird. what is going on?
Are we setting a record?
No,
or something?
I think so. Jennifer Burns, your thoughts on this?
where I'd like to start, I guess, because there's a lot to say here.
Yep.
Is that passing the legislation that empowers poll watchers really legalizes voter intimidation.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the state is doing. I mean, that's what the impact will be, because I don't know how they get poll watchers in Texas. Like, do people apply? Who's the person who scans those or reviews the application? Who's in charge of appointing the poll watchers? So that can be incredibly partisan. And then you allow people. It's legalized voter intimidation at the poll place. The other thing is these little intricate pieces in this new legislation, like that if people drive non-related people to vote, they have to fill out paperwork beforehand that they're doing that. And that right there, I mean, if you think about it, how many times do you jump in the car and ride together? And we know that that is a tactic that has been used by African Americans and other minorities, you know, leaving churches or going from home where they carpool.
Right.
So you'd have to fill out paperwork. So that kind of little kind of loophole in there is a very powerful, has a very powerful impact. And the other thing I find interesting is that Governor Abbott has defunded the legislators. So some of them won't get paid in August. So he's also sort of using extortion, or at least financial manipulation, on these Democrats or others to do their job. And I find that very interesting and kind of astounding that no one's pointing out the way he's playing with the taxpayers' dollars when it comes to that.
My question is, how are they going to track who's bringing whom to the polls? Well, do you have to have a pass? I mean, you know, how are they going to do that? And you know, providing rides to the polls is one of the great get-out-the-vote activities that we do when people need a ride to the polls. So
you're asking how they enforce that?
Right. So how do they enforce that? That you're signing or, you know, filling out the paperwork. And I don't know what it's like in Texas, but there's a difference between election inspectors and poll watchers. And the poll watchers are partisan, and they are brought in by the various parties to track voters and all that sort of stuff and see what's going on. The election inspectors are the people who sit behind the tables. Now, it could be one and the same under this law in Texas, which would make it even more scary and more unfair.
Hey, you know, if you think about this, this is back to what we got out of all of those years ago.
That's right.
When somebody had to come in and recite the Constitution in order to get a vote. I mean, this is what it is. We know it. We see it. And we're not doing enough about it. Of course, the Democrats know it in the legislature, in the Congress. But whether they can make it stick, I don't know. Whether some guy from West Virginia says, I don't like this this idea of telling states what they have to do. So it's not good. It's terrible.
Jim Handler.
Yeah, I wish I could disagree with you, Alan. I agree completely. However, you know, I think there's a couple things. So one is, you know, they're getting very subtle in this, right? Like these ride rules and things like that, because they know that, you know, in the white suburbs, two people jump in a car, no one's going to tell. In the inner cities, you're talking vans full of people, and that's what's going to guess who's going to end up being called on it. And then, of course, if they raise suspicion, I suspect they're able to hold the votes, things like that. So, you know, I think the only thing that's really going to overcome this stuff is, you know, sort of what we saw happen in Georgia. They passed laws, so the Stacey Abrams and that crew got a lot of people out, and we just got to get a lot of people out to vote, and Texans and Arizonans and Georgians and
Texas
just have to get out there.
Is getting more purple every day. And so, you know, they might be doing this at their own peril.
Yeah, and I would be very curious whether the election assistance that they're cutting back on, I bet you that's multi-language stuff, particularly Spanish, but we'll see.
Meanwhile, we assume, Alan, all of this will wind up in the courts, but what will this current makeup of the court,
well,
do?
We already saw.
Yeah, we already saw that. Well, they let, what, Arizona
stand? 6-3.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think you've answered the question. I want to go back to Libby, who said might. It might mean, you know, that people, as I have often said on the show, might schmite. that's not the way it's going right now. That's Texas, and the idea is to keep that majority, the way that it's always been, the white folks in charge. And they'll do anything in their power to make sure it stays this way. This is, I've never seen anything like that, like this, since I was a kid, when this was a matter of the way that Southern states did it. They just wanted to exclude black voters.
Jennifer.
Well, and I think this is also, you know, it comes on the heels of the federal legislation for Juneteenth, right? And Juneteenth is a celebration of the end of slavery in Texas. Though, obviously, the end of slavery did not come until ratification of the 13th Amendment, which was months later, for it to be a, you know, nationwide abolition of slavery. But so you get this national remembrance and recognition in a holiday toward black people is how it is often construed. And then here is the backlash to it. We're going to, you know, go back to almost Reconstruction wording, Reconstruction era wording, and find all these loopholes to create a Jim Crow system of voting suppression. And that's exactly what we're seeing.
When you,
you know, it's easy to say that, you know, it's Juneteenth that has inspired this reactionary nonsense. But it's also as American as apple pie in those southern states, keeping black people from voting. So whatever it was, I think it's really consistent with everything we're seeing right now as we go forward and they try to just make sure that the whites get the vote and the blacks don't. Simple. Just always been that way.
Erica writes to us and says, while I understand these voting laws are restrictive and we know the strategy behind it, what makes anyone think it's going to actually work? First, it's a Republican plan, so, well, there's that. But also, what happens when it backfires? I don't think it's Pollyannish to think that people who don't or haven't voted will show up to save democracy. Example, my family, 3 members, never voted. We do now. My mom never voted, 72. She does now. We can't be the only people who have been woken by the dirtbag and that dirtbag and his cronies, meaning the elected Republican Party. Will they change the laws back when it doesn't work out?
Where do they vote? Where do these folks who wrote the letter vote? Do we know this?
No.
Oh. Well, that's important.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, but every vote is important everywhere because, you know, just imagine how much worse this all becomes if we lose the Senate and or the House. So at the moment,
which, by the way, which is a very good chance of happening.
Yep. Which is why we need people to get out there and vote.
That's right.
Well, I guess the other question to bring up here, too, is, you know, what is the percentage or the demographic of Latino voters in Texas? And where does that fall? Because we're talking in a very black and white binary.
Right.
But that group is definitely one to be paying attention to. And we know in the past that the Republicans in many of those southern states have been able to increase Latinos voting for them. So will this legislation benefit them? Well, we saw it in Florida and other places where there was an increase in Latino voters the Republicans, for Trump.
I know, but explain it. In other words, what do you think is going on that more Latino voters are seeing themselves as part of the, at least this is the way I'm seeing it, the white majority?
Well, Jennifer, do you want to say anything or can I jump in?
Go ahead, Libby. You go first.
Okay, thank you. I think, first of all, the Latinx community is lighter skinned than the African American community. So that's one thing. So from a visual point of view, there are black Latinx people out there, Dominicans. You know, we saw there was a bit of a brouhaha about In the Heights and not enough black Latino representation in the film. But you also have, it's a very Catholic community. They are still churchgoers and they tend to skew more conservative. You have some folks, especially in Florida, Southern Florida, are still reeling about Castro and the failure of the Bay of Pigs that you mentioned before, Alan. And so the Latinx vote is not as monolithic as, say, we think the African American vote is in this country. And I think the African American vote is skews more Democratic, but there are still have plenty of Black Republicans, you know. But you can't say just because somebody's a person of color, they're going to vote a certain way. It has to do with their own politics and their experience in America.
Yeah, but we know what happens. We know that people of color tend to vote with the Democrats. That doesn't mean there aren't exceptions, Libby, as you point out. But I'm fascinated by this idea of what happens to the Latinx community and whether or not there is some, well, for want of a better word, racial prejudice there on the part of those people who come from a Latin point of view. Now, we know that more Latins vote for the Democrats. We know it. But you're right. This is something that's in flux.
Do you want to say anything more? No.
Does anybody Jennifer? Want to touch that one?
Jennifer?
Well, I think, you know, as Libby and Alan have said, the Latinx experience in America is different from the African-American experience. And I'm not trying to overgeneralize.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Because the communities themselves are very diverse.
Understood.
But also, when we look at the census for people of Latinx heritage, you know, the diversity within it, even on the census when they would report, that didn't come around until the last, like, 40 years, that they would be, you know, non-white Hispanics. And there's always been this middle ground in America where Asian Americans and Latinx Americans, or, you know, people from, I want to say immigrants, but from other nations who may have been born here but have that ethnic history, nationality to other countries, have fallen in between Black and white. And there has been some tremendous advantages in being able to not be associated with African Americans when it comes to policies. So in that middle ground area, they're able or have been able to separate themselves, as Libby was pointing out, not just visually in that they're lighter skinned, but also in some of the ways integration and other programs worked, where schools could integrate by saying they had Mexicans rather than bringing mm-hmm. Black people into the schools, white schools, you know, and so forth. So, you know, there's that zone of still trying to protect the advantages you have gotten or could get from these Republican policies by distinguishing yourself from or separating yourself from African Americans. And I would say part of this also, and I don't know enough about this, is where people actually live, what counties they live. Is there a racial segregation kind of pattern? Because obviously this comes down to counties and who's voting where you see the benefits for people who are Latinx or Asian American in Texas, that they're in different counties for voting, and therefore these policies would benefit them more.
Anybody else?
Go ahead, Ellen. I was just going to say, you know, I always have to throw in something about data and what it actually tells us. There's not a lot here because I don't have that kind of county level stuff. Jennifer's right that that's what we really need to see this. But what we do know is that Trump made inroads with all demographics with the people who had not been college educated.
Right.
And so therefore, most of those places, most of those demographics which have traditionally fought for college rights, so Latinx and Black, you saw, I mean, the Black community was still 92% Democratic, but that 8% came split, you know, it split more when you do it by education, but the Latinx, much more obvious split by education. So part of that is the Republicans do play well to a group by going with the anti-elite, by going with...
Which is so bizarre because they are the elite,
yeah.
Right? And
well,
they get these people to believe
because, yeah.
They get these people to believe that they're on their side.
We're really, really late for break,
okay,
so let's
sorry.
Do that. No, it's all right. It's not your fault. We'll
take Thank you so much.
We'll take a break.
Fascinating stuff.
Well, it certainly is. We'll continue with the fascination, and we'll include letters when we come back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Monday morning. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. A lot of letters on this fascinating topic. We go to Marty. The Republicans have so heavily gerrymandered state legislative districts that it really doesn't matter if states like Texas are becoming purple. They are also set to control a large majority of the upcoming redistricting. The game is now so rigged that it's almost irreversible. Removing or altering the filibuster and passing federal voting rights legislation and Supreme Court reform is the only hope. Libby, anything on that?
You know, I know that the gerrymandering is absolutely horrible, and I think the filibuster does have to go, because it is a remnant of the elite perspective of the U.S. Senate, that it's a different chamber, that it is the higher chamber. And what it has done is made any kind of progress almost impossible, especially in this kind of incredibly polarized partisanship that we're living through right now.
All right. I hate reading this letter, but I'm going to read it anyway.
I'll bet I know which one. Go ahead.
Thank you for your enlightening experience and listening to five white people explaining how African American and Latinos think.
How does anybody on the other end know who's white and who's not?
Yeah.
Apparently, I sound white. This is Jennifer Burns.
Jennifer, that is so annoying on the part of the writer. That presumption is ignorant.
Yeah.
It's not the first time that I've faced it, so that says something too.
Mm-hmm. Well, we thank you very much. We try to keep, you know, obviously we try to keep our panels diverse in all opinions, and that goes across all different lines,
And it is to your credit, Joe, and that of the people who are doing the recruiting, like Sarah LaDuke,
yep,
for the people who are on here, that we are consistently diverse in terms of African American presence. So, you know, that kind of ignorant and rather. Well, forget it.
Look, the fact is we could always do more, and everybody can do more, but I think assuming the worst is not necessarily the best tactic either. Doug writes, the current unbalanced by Republicans' Supreme Court already has destroyed the 1965 Voting Act. If Manchin and Sinema actually relent on the filibuster to allow H.R. 1 and the John Lewis Act to pass, what will stop the Supreme Court from destroying those?
Well, it'll take a while for it to wind its way through the courts to get there, and perhaps by then the makeup of the court might change. I doubt it, but you never know.
Well, you have to have an awful lot of people dying.
I know.
Well, I think it's also
for that to happen.
Sorry, but I think it's also easier for the court to rule when something comes from a state as a state's right thing than when it's a constitutional issue, when you have an explicit amendment in there. So the court, at least the previous courts, have not always been friendly to voting rights, and we saw that mm-hmm. last court was not
right
very good.
And
but what they did was they said, you know, it has to take an act of Congress to fix this. So if there is an act of Congress, who knows?
Alan?
Yeah, I think that there's another thing here. This court in particular, and John Roberts specifically, understand that the court itself is under some real danger here. Mm-hmm. People are talking about expanding the number of justices. People are talking about all kinds of fixes because the Supreme Court has gotten, through Trump, let's face it, 6-3 into a place where if they continue to follow their natural instincts, which are horrendous, there could be ways in which the political situation changed for them. And I think they know that.
Anybody else? Okay, one more letter here, and then we'll take a break, if that is all right with everyone. We go to, this is a good one, actually. Chris says, I hope that a groundswell of people come out and vote against the Republicans, but these voter suppression laws are intended to counter a groundswell like that. What concrete steps are the Democrats taking to counter these efforts? That's a really good question. So you know this is happening. As the other party, what are they doing?
Well, in Texas, they may just walk out like they did the first time to deny a quorum so that they can't do a vote.
Yeah, but that can't last over the long run.
No.
It shows the way people are thinking. No, but I think there are ways in which this could happen. You bring cases to court. You just make it clear to the American people that one side is trying to steal an election.
Well, and you make this into a voting issue. You make huge voter drives. Last time, again, Georgia's the model you used, the registration moves were way up, and that's the one thing it's very hard for them to keep people from doing, because registering to vote would be something that even the Supreme Court can't take away. It's a basic right.
So, hard but not impossible.
Yeah, well, I was going to say it would have to be a pretty subtle thing. Like, prisoners' rights and things like that are where the edges are right now. But you can imagine things they do. So, for example, they have been making it hard, for example, for college students to vote where the college is instead of their home.
And vote in their college
things
communities.
Like that. But even that, there's ways around if they can make things happen. So, it's a tough case, and it just requires getting voters out there and getting votes to happen.
Jennifer, anything you want to say on that?
No.
Okay. Final
note.
I agree is good. John writes real quick, please consider what New York does to limit voting access for independent and minor party voters is as severe in its non-democratic spirit as anything Governor Abbott has done. We'll pause there for a moment. We'll take a break. We have news with Ray Graff, and we'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Monday. It is the 12th of July, 7 minutes past the hour of 10 o'clock. Alan Chartok is with us, Jennifer Burns, Jim Hendler, and Libby Post. We welcome your letters as always. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. Whenever Jim is on the show, I go places in the internet that I don't normally go to try to find like good tech stories to talk about, and I try to think of, oh, this will be something interesting to talk about. Well, the best tech story I could come up with for this one is the idea of space tourism. And I don't know if how you feel about this, or even you care about this, or even if you consider this a tech story, but now we're just like raffling off tickets for people to go up into the wild blue yonder, and it all comes out of Richard Branson completing the Virgin Galactic flight aiming to open up space tourism. The successful trip was the first in a series to the edge of space. And I want to talk about exactly what that is, the edge of space. And beyond, by billionaire entrepreneurs that seek to make human space flight more routine. This happened this weekend, soaring more than 50 miles into the hot, glaringly bright skies above New Mexico. Richard Branson at last fulfilled a dream that took decades to realize. He can now call himself an astronaut. And on Sunday morning, a small rocket plane operated by Virgin Galactic, which Mr. Branson founded in 2004, carried him and five other people to the edge of space and back. More than an hour later, Mr. Branson took the stage to celebrate, saying the whole thing was magical. And guess what? If everything goes well, you can experience the magic too.
Oh, gosh, I don't even know where to start. I've been a space geek for a long time. However, it's important to understand about this. This isn't the first space tourism, right? So, for example, I forget when it was. Must have been at least a decade ago. Charles Simonyi, who most people haven't heard of, but he was one of the founders of Microsoft, one of the early Microsoft employees, multi-billionaire. He took, I saw a talk he gave one time about his summer vacation where he took his 2-week trip to MIR, the International Space Station. Didn't say how much he paid, but suffice to say it was enough to get him there. And
probably more than going to Hawaii for a week.
I suspect a little more. Yeah. And in fact, his girlfriend told us about cooking the meals for him. This was a woman named Martha Stewart, who you all heard of. So, I mean, this is not your average couple, to say the least. This was multi-billionaire stuff. And so is this. So what's different this time is he went up in a Russian rocket, created by the Russian government. So... There have been people who've gone up to what's called the edge of space. Edge of space is 50 miles up, is traditionally considered the boundary between where our atmosphere ends and space begins, and it has to do with the amount of gravity and things like that. But really, it's a pretty arbitrary number. But, you're weightless up there. You're basically you look out your window, the sky's no longer blue, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it is generally considered. So the U.S. government gives astronaut wings to people who've been to space, and that's where they draw the line, is 50 miles. So this is the first time a commercial company has built something that took people into space. And that's where this big thing about space tourism comes in. And, of course, Bezos is supposed to be coming up in his company's one next week. But for a long time now, commercial space has been growing. The cost of getting things into space is very high, but has been coming down because commercial companies can do things that government has trouble doing in terms of the contracting, in terms of the innovation. So it's a very exciting time, but in a fairly small part of the space market. You know, we're not really talking about that trip to the moon anytime soon.
No.
Would you go,
ask Alan?
Yeah. Give me $200,000, I'm there tomorrow, guys.
is that what it costs, around $200,000?
They had about 60 people, I think they said, or maybe more than that. I forget the number, but a lot of people have put $200,000 deposits down. Their goal is to get it to $200,000. Dollars. It's unclear at the moment whether $200,000 is the actual cost. That's just the number that's being thrown around. And then this raffling off two tickets. I'm not sure what you have to do to get into the raffle, but I'm looking it up as soon as
Give
we get
up
off
your
the
soul.
Air.
Randy writes to us, and this is a wonderful WAMC listener who asked this question. What is the climate impact from space tourism? Can we really afford going back and forth?
You know, at the moment, it's such a small amount that it's hard to say. I did see an analysis once of the space program and, the booster rockets that are used to put people into distant space to get the rovers to Mars and things like that are far more powerful than what was used yesterday. And as far as I can tell, the number was like tiny. I mean, it was, a fraction of a percent. So, yeah, it could be eventually a problem. But right now, compared to airlines and cars, you're just nowhere near it. Thing is, it's gratuitous tourism. But the other thing is, for a long time, people have been talking about edge of space planes. If you could get the price down low enough, which we're nowhere near and we don't have the technology to do yet, then you're talking about, being able to get, say, from the U.S. to China in an hour, hour and a half. Mm-hmm. That would change things drastically.
Alan?
I don't want to be, I don't want to be unctuous about this, but obviously, we can say, well, it's a very small part of our footprint. Every time I throw out a piece of plastic, I think of Judith Eng hitting me on the head with an umbrella.
a non-plastic umbrella.
That's right. Nevertheless, it still all adds up. So we can say it's a small part, but I think it's a tough one.
All I would say, Alan, is if you want to end climate change issues, this isn't the place to start. There are lots of places to start.
Judith says, listen, Alan, don't use plastic and don't put it in your garbage can, which we all know I do. And, it's true.
Anybody else on the going to space? Lydia, you gone?
No.
Yeah.
To me, you know what this is to me? Between Branson and Bezos, boys and their toys.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I agree.
Jennifer, any thoughts on going to space or near space or whatever the hell it is?
No, it seems very like Disney World Epcot to me.
Yeah.
In real life. Yeah,
that's the thing. If I want to go to out of space, I'll go to Disney, and I'll do the virtual reality.
And I don't
and
even
I'll go
like
to the Star Wars.
And
pavilion.
I don't even like that because it just feels like you're sort of in a choreographed car wreck.
Well,
I mean, it just takes your body up, shakes it, and then brings you down.
I have so much fun with those. I love
All right,
them. Yeah,
very good.
How old are these guys? How old are these guys, Joe?
Branson, Richard Branson, I think is in his 60s. Oh, is he?
No, he's 70.
Oh, what?
All right, he's older. So he's 70. And Jeff Bezos, our friend from Amazon, is 57.
Yeah. Well, one would think that, you know, as you get older and want to go up to see the world from, you know, that perspective, here comes trouble.
Here you go.
Here comes trouble.
Yeah.
One says, you know, since God has term limits, this is what rich guys who have a lot of money do with that money.
Yeah.
You couldn't pay me $200,000 to get in one of those rocket ships.
No. But I think, you know, Jim said at the very beginning, being a space geek, and I think some people are interested and fascinated by it. I mean, I find the space program interesting, and certainly we have made great strides in it over the decades. However, I don't have any real interest of being an astronaut, or I would have learned math and science better, but I did not.
It's a little late for that now.
Yeah, I know, exactly. Okay. Sybil says, if we on Earth haven't been able to stop pollution here, going up into space without any regulations is a big disaster waiting to occur. Not against science at all. I'm against manipulative actions under the name of progress. Yeah, I mean, that's one thing, Jim, is that when we go up in these, when NASA or even other powers who go up have a reason for going up. We're going to accomplish this, 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 and this. And for NASA, much of that coming out of RPI. So there's a point to it. What's the point here?
You know, I it's hard to answer that question, Joe, but, you know, think about things like ecotourism and stuff like that. They let us see things that others don't get to see, and that let us see some of the natural world that unfortunately is disappearing. But at the same time, it puts money into the revitalization of those things. It can be done right. Space, again, it's just such a long time from now before these even become real issues. I mean, we're talking about five people now. We're talking about the total number of space. There's a much bigger issue in space, which is a space junk issue, if you really want to get into geeky issues. You know, every time there's a satellite up there, every time there's this. So any one of those hitting any of these space planes, the reason they're not going much beyond the edge of space, partly is because they want to get back.
Because there is pollution up there already.
Because you got to worry about that. So we track the big ones. But, tiny little fragments do tremendous damage to the International Space Station, things like that. There's a lot of economic things that could be done in space. There's power things that could be done. There's manufacturing things done. So that's really what's been pushing people to push the technology. I think the tourism aspect of it, you know, I joke about, yes, I would go up. Would I pay to go up? Probably not. But not that kind of cost. Get it down to a couple K, I'll think about it.
Maybe you can, put it in as a project at RPI, and it's computing, and it has to do with your new presidency.
Maybe I could.
Because that's a computing machine.
Branson as the president.
Right.
There you go.
It's a computing machine, so it makes sense.
But, Jim, if you had billions of dollars, and it was this would be a very, very tiny part of what you had. Would you change your mind?
I would love to have the experiences that could let me answer that hypothetical.
Because we have a lot of those.
I'm a few zeros away from that, to say the least.
Well, but we have a lot of those. We have a lot of those people.
No, I know, and there are people, and I do know people who have said, you know, if they got the cost down to the hundreds of thousands of dollars, they would go. But you know, again, it's an experience, and how much do you pay for the experience, and how much do you pay for being one of the first people to do something? I don't know. I mean, you know, again, I was being a little flippant when that, but I think that, you know, look at the fact that this has become a big story when it's really no big deal. I mean, it's really not that big of a deal, except that we all have this space thing in us. It's the thing that we haven't explored. So I'd also love to go down to the ocean vents, but those are even harder to get to. So.
Right. Yeah.
Well, I have a question about this, because as I was seeing this, and this is a commercialized industry now, are people banking on this to expand the job market or job opportunities in engineering and space travel? Like, does this become a new employment industry?
Yes.
Right? Like, there's more jobs now for engineers that can go into space, you know, travel or design or the research for these private companies. Will there be an advancement in maybe private corporations being the ones to investigate this space cleanup that we're talking about?
Yeah, so SpaceX and some of the other companies have already been doing a lot of hiring. You know, it used to be if you wanted to go into this field, you went to NASA.
Right.
Or you ended up in an airplane company. I mean, there's plenty of others. But now, you know, there's also this commercial opportunity, and it's growing. And once the prices get to a commodity level, so for satellite launch, satellites are now launched as often by commercial as governmental things. Usually it's a mix. Nowadays. So again, as these things become doable and will pay for themselves, those industries grow and hire people.
I migrated away from the story on my computer, but the trip was an hour, is that right?
Yeah, it wasn't that long. Yeah.
Right. So $200,000 for an hour?
That's why you have to be a billionaire, Joe.
I mean, insert your own Elliot Spitzer joke, but please. Okay. Karen writes, I think we have more pressing problems on Earth than adding to climate change so rich people can fly to the edge of space. At least when people use planes to travel, they are going somewhere for something. They are contributing to the economy in those areas. Space tourism is flying for no real reason than to say you've been there. And before you say it's not making much of an impact, building that huge hangar in the middle of the desert used precious resources for anything associated with this venture will use resources that only benefit the wealthy. Libby's right, rich boys and the ridiculous toys. That from Karen. Sue checks in and says, I watched Summer of Soul last night. It's rather synchronistic than that the release of the Harlem Music Festival footage from 1969 covered the reaction to the first moon landing among the crowd. Most said the dollars spent on space travel would have been better spent on food, housing, jobs for their communities. Here we still are with misplaced priorities and male egos. That from Sue.
I said that when I was a kid and in school, and people thought I was nuts, but I thought that it was misplaced. I always have.
You know, I fall on the geek's defense, which is that there's a ton of stuff. There's a ton of stuff we have now on Earth that we wouldn't have had without the space program pushing us to develop some of it, but also experimenting with some of the materials that we were able to learn about in zero grav in the way that we couldn't in gravity. Well, I mean, you know, again, yes, I think there are certainly many things we spend money on Earth that the money could be better spent elsewhere. I certainly like to see educational investment grow significantly compared to growing, say, military or other type investments necessarily. But again, you know, my real feel is I agree with all the people who are saying rich boys and their toys and things like that. But, you know, again, as a fraction of the stuff I worry about, that's a lot lower than a lot of other things, like the stuff we were talking about in the first half of the show with
voting.
Haiti and Trump and voting, I think are far more important issues. And boy, would I like to see Bezos and Branson and those people invest in voting rights the way they're investing in space. That would be wonderful.
All right. We just have a few minutes before our bottom of the hour break. And so let's go to another story. This is, want to talk a little bit about COVID. Of course, we're seeing numbers rise for the first time in several months. Very, I think, concerning rises amongst those largely who have not been vaccinated in areas where vaccination rates are very low. But despite outbreaks among the unvaccinated, the New York Times is writing today about Fox News host smearing the shots. So I think this is why are we talking about Fox News? Well, we're talking about a population that is not getting the shot. Right. In red areas, and their main news source is this network, which is telling them not to get the shot. So months after Rupert Murdoch got a COVID-19 dose, Tucker Carlson called a Biden vaccination proposal the greatest scandal in my lifetime. Back in December, before the Queen of England and President-elect of the United States had their turns, the media mogul Rupert Murdoch received a dose of COVID-19 vaccine. Afterward, he urged everyone else to get it too. Since then, a different message has been a repeated refrain on the primetime shows hosted by Tucker Carlson and Laura Ingraham on Mr. Murdoch's Fox News channel, a message at odds with the recommendations of health experts. Even as the virus's Delta variant and other mutations fuel outbreaks in areas where vaccination rates are below the national average, Mr. Carlson and Ms. Ingraham and the guests on their programs have said on the air that the vaccines could be dangerous, that people are justified in refusing them, and that public authorities have overstepped in their attempts to deliver them. Mr. Carlson and Ms. Ingraham last week criticized a plan by the Biden administration to increase vaccinations by having healthcare workers and volunteers go door to door to try to persuade the reluctant to get shots. Going door to door, Ms. Ingraham asked, this is creepy stuff. Mr. Carlson, the highest-rated Fox News host, I'll let that sink in for a moment, with an average of 2.9 million viewers, said the Biden plan was an attempt to force people to take medicine they don't want and they don't need. He called the initiative the greatest scandal of my lifetime by far. Mr. Carlson's guest on that episode, the veteran Fox News political analyst Britt Hume, pushed back slightly, saying what they're trying to do is make it as easy as possible for people to get the vaccine and for people who are hesitant to perhaps encourage them that they have nothing to fear. Mr. Hume was quick to add that vaccines do have side effects and said those who are hesitant should be respected. One last word on this. Opposition to vaccines was once relegated to the fringes of American politics, and the rhetoric on Fox News has coincided with efforts by right-wing extremists to bash vaccination efforts. In other words, if it sells, go with it.
One would think that Tucker Carlson, if he wants to keep his ratings up, would be telling these people to get vaccinated. Because
you don't want your audience to die.
Right. You don't want your audience to die, and that's what's going to happen. We're seeing it in Missouri. We're seeing it in other places. And
they know it.
Yeah. And it just makes absolutely no sense. Nobody is going to walk into a house, strap somebody to a chair, and give them the vaccine. That's not what this program is.
So.
It's about getting the information to people, giving them the option, and make it easier for them to get vaccinated.
Alan.
So, I know there will be people who take this the wrong way, and I do apologize in advance. Should Tucker Carlson be indicted for murder? Yeah. I mean, the reason I say that is there will be people who die because they listen to this idiot.
It'll
and
be a
lot
Law and
of people.
Order episode.
Be a Law and Order episode.
Well, unfortunately, it ain't there anymore. A major Law and Order star once said to me, Alan, there will be life after Law and Order, but the answer is there hasn't been.
But it is an interesting question as to who becomes liable and culpable when you're actively telling people against what, Jim, you're my go-to in this, what science tells us. We've got about a minute. We can pick it on the
side. I just often ask myself, what's in it for these people in trying to deny this stuff? And the answer that always seems to come back to is it's a bashing of science generally. Mm-hmm. And where does that come to? Is this somehow there's this belief that science and religion are antithetical to each other? And I've never understood that as a religious scientist, but there appear to be, that seems to be a major factor that's used in building the right wing connection to evangelism. And, you know, once you're anti-science, then you have to be anti-all science. You can't just say, well, the COVID stuff's good, but it's crazy to me because, you know, it's proven.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue this. We'll get the rest of the panel's thoughts on it, and we'll move on with your letters and other topics as well. We'll finish up with our last go-round after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Jim Henler. We also have Jennifer Burns and Libby Post on our program, and we welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. So while we're talking, right before the break, we were talking about Fox News hosts who are actively warning people against getting vaccines, people in areas where vaccine rates are very low. And by the way, we are seeing the numbers of COVID cases rise in those areas. The nation's, meanwhile, the nation's top infectious disease expert expressed horror on Sunday over attendees of CPAC, the conservative political conference, loudly applauding the inability of the federal government to hit its vaccine goals. With new variants of COVID-19 now surging in areas with low vaccination rates and right-wing media promoting vaccine hesitancy to its viewers, the Conservative Political Action Conference in Texas invited noted COVID contrarian Alex Berenson to fearmonger about the safe and effective coronavirus vaccines. Speaking on the CPAC stage on Saturday, Berenson, who The Atlantic once labeled the pandemic's wrongest man, prompted cheers from the crowd when he boasted that the government was hoping they could sort of sucker 90% of the population into getting a shot. I just lost my place and I apologize. Yes, 90% of the population and getting vaccinated, and says it isn't happening, which got huge applause. During an appearance on CNN's State of the Union with Jake Tapper, Biden chief medical advisor Dr. Anthony Fauci lamented over the inexplicable pushing back against the vaccines from certain sections of the population. Furthermore, he took issue with accusations that the Biden administration was going door to door to force people to get vaccinated. We've got to put aside the ideological difference or differences thinking that someone is forcing you to do something, Fauci said. The public health officials like myself and my colleagues are asking you to do something that will ultimately save your life and that of your family and that of the community. He added, I mean, it's ideological rigidity, I think. There's no reason not to get vaccinated.
You know. Right. There is no reason not to get vaccinated, and I think it should be mandatory. And once the CDC makes it a non-emergency vaccine, but a however they classify it, it should be mandatory. I mean, St. Peter's, the Trinity Health Partners who run St. Peter's, they've said shot or pink slip. That's your option. And I, you know, I'm sorry, but, well, actually, I'm not sorry. It should be mandatory. Public health trumps all. The problem is that these people are challenging the veracity of public health, the veracity of science, and they think they know more than the people who have the education and the experience to know what's right and wrong. And, you know,
but
it's
why?
About facts. And
but why?
But why what?
That's the question.
Why?
But why are these people eschewing what they we have the facts. We know you get a vaccination, you're going to be protected. We know you don't. You're not going to be protected. And yet, in huge numbers, usually on the right of center, these people come forward and they say, we're not going to do it, and you're doing terrible things to us, when they should know different.
And you know why, Alan? I think it goes back to that one speech that Trump gave during the campaign, I love the uneducated. It gave absolute license, as all of his rhetoric and behavior has done, for people to act badly and to revel in their ignorance.
Would you say one and one doesn't make two? I mean, it seems to me everybody who ever went to school, everybody who took arithmetic, everybody, you know, I mean, these people, you can say they're stupid, but and I believe they are, because they're not going to save their own lives. But I don't get it. I just can't figure out what it is that makes somebody basically commit suicide.
Well, what makes young mothers believe that Jenny McCarthy gives out better medical advice than their pediatrician and refuse to vaccinate their children only to then possibly lose their child to a horrible childhood disease? I mean, it doesn't make sense.
Jennifer Burns.
I have a question, and this is really, do we know if Trump was vaccinated?
He was.
Or
he was.
The Trump family? Wait, so
they were.
Yeah, they were.
Prior to leaving office, my understanding.
And so the Trump family was, and how about the majority of Republicans in Congress and the House?
I'm sure they were.
Most of them, not all of them.
Okay.
Maybe
so
not
here is
Marjorie
Tucker
Taylor
Carlson.
What about Tucker Carlson?
Yeah, I don't know if Tucker yeah. or Laura have the shot.
I'd be surprised
right.
if
so,
they didn't.
So here they are touting, you know, go against this, don't believe it. It is the government controlling you. And yet, even the audience here that they're trying to keep so cultish for Trump and his crew have all been vaccinated. So there's also that part of this irreality here where you're saying the vaccine is going to be so bad for people, but then the greatest leaders of your party, mm-hmm. not saying they are, but as people look at them, they've all got the vaccine. So that makes it even more befuddling right there.
Well, and then add that.
I love the word befuddling. Go ahead.
I was going to say, and add to that the fact that the anti-government red states, or supposedly anti-government red states, are now demanding that the federal government help pay for the hospitalizations of all these people who are filling their emergency rooms with COVID. The spike this weekend and this past week is insane as Delta sweeps through the unvaccinated in those states. And they still, you know, are denying it while filling the hospital wards. It's just hard to understand.
While many Fox News personalities, including the entire staff of Fox Fox and Friends in the morning, have been vaccinated, Tucker Carlson has refused to respond to any request for comment on whether he has been vaccinated or not.
Which means he has
which
been.
Which means he has, yeah.
It would seem that way,
yeah.
right? It
yeah.
would
yeah.
seem that way. While most of the other co-hosts of various Fox programs have on their social media put selfies saying that they have gotten the shot, they're not saying, Tucker Carlson and his folks are not saying whether he has received the shot or not.
Just across the T here, Joe, it makes him particularly despicable.
Mm-hmm.
If you think that a guy who protects himself and then tells others not to do it is really despicable.
Yes, and yet another example of just how despicable a human being.
Right. I mean, it just goes to show.
Yeah. So I think during the break we were asking this question of the states of the hot spots that we see. Right now, we are seeing hotspots in Florida, Louisiana, Arkansas, Missouri, Texas, Colorado, and Montana, and areas of yep. great concern. These
right.
are, for the most part, yes, red states, and in some places, the like Louisiana, for example, 36% of the population is fully vaccinated. Other places like Alabama and Mississippi, it is below, it is hovering around 30% of the people have been vaccinated. So this is obviously troublesome as we try to get a handle on COVID, and as the numbers creep up and become more and more concerning, especially because of the Delta variant. And, oh, by the way, what about new variants? And then I guess we could also talk about the Pfizer effort to say mm-hmm. that perhaps we need boosters, with the CDC saying not so fast, which to me is also another really interesting aspect of this story. I just threw a lot out there. Anybody want to take any scrap of what I just said?
We'll think about it for a minute. Pfizer could be explained in a lot of different ways, right? One of them is we'll make more money.
Right.
That's one way of seeing it. The other is that they're genuinely concerned and think they have the ability to save lives, and they can't understand why we're not doing it. This business of these red states not having people not getting vaccinated when the proof is right before their eyes and they still refuse to do what would preserve their lives and their children's lives and their parents' lives. It really is something.
Well, and the selfishness of it, and not only with respect to the people they know and stuff, but look, you know, where these variants come from is where you have outbreaks. That's how diseases mutate, is where they are. And so, you know, we are put at risk by the fact that these states are not taking this seriously, despite filling up their hospital rooms.
We are just about out of time, but I just want to read just a couple of facts. When we talk about just the last 14 days because of this Delta variant, we have seen a 60% overall change in the United States, an uptick, up 60% in 14 days. The 14-day change is plus 60%. However, in states, Arkansas, 196%, Alabama, 159%, Kansas, 150%, Mississippi, 110%, Louisiana, 142%. So really striking numbers. All right, we're going to take a break. I'm sorry, we're out of time, actually. We're going to say goodbye. Well, we're going to take a break from this, and we'll have Congressional Corner next. But I thank you all for being here. Alan, thank you so much.
It's great.
Jennifer, Jim, and Libby, thank you. We'll be back right after this.